Howdy do, buckaroos. This is the Mac Observer Daily Observations podcast for Monday, the 26th of November, 2018. I am your host, Kelly Gamont. With me today, I have Dave Hamilton. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Kelly. Thanks for having me. I'm back after our turkey-infused holiday celebrations. Good to be here.
And also joining me fresh off a turkey coma is Andrew Orr. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Excellent. Now, Andrew, I want to start with you today because you actually wrote a piece this morning about LinkedIn privacy, which is one of the privacy and security are important things. And particularly when it comes to information about your job, your work history, that kind of thing, it's probably important. So take us through that.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been hearing a lot in the news about Facebook and Twitter and their privacy settings, but LinkedIn is just as important. Credit to this goes to Lifehacker. That's where I found it. So there's basically five steps you can do to lock in your privacy on LinkedIn. So first, and this is something that you should be doing on as many accounts as you can, but you should turn on two-factor authentication.
Yes.
And there are apps you can use to do that. I recommend avoiding SMS-based authentication wherever possible, and there are specific apps you can use, like Authy or a password manager like 1Password can manage your codes for you.
Mm-hmm. Now, for people who don't know what two-factor is, two-factor authentication is when you sign in with your email address or your username, and then usually what happens is when it sees that your sign-in is being attempted, there's a second step that goes to that. Like, you don't only need your username or your email address, whatever it is. You also need a second piece of information. So usually the two factors that they talk about are something you know, like your email address or your username, and something you have, like getting a phone call.
Something you know would be your password, not your username or email address, right? Do I have that wrong?
No, I think that's right.
I think you're right. I think I just needed more coffee before I started telling people about security.
That's okay.
So please jump in.
You have your username and your password. So that's one factor, right?
Yes.
And then something else, as you said, a second factor, which is this code that could be, as Andrew pointed out, insecurely SMS'd to you or mm-hmm. securely generated by an app like Authy or 1Password or something like that. It is important, though, because now the security conscious folks in the know are driving their cars, waving both of their arms, and that's dangerous. So put them back on the wheel. when we start talking about an app like 1Password or Authy that can generate this code, we often float into two-step authentication, not two-factor, because it can all be done on the same device, right? You could have 1Password store your username, your password, and the ability to generate this code.
Yes.
That's not another factor. That's just another step because it's all doable from one device. Like for one of our banks, in order to do wire transfers, the same thing happens. I have to enter our username, our password, and then one of these routinely time-sensitive codes, right, where it changes all the time. But I cannot generate that code with 1Password. I have to use a second factor, which is this, I hate it because I have to carry it around with me when I travel, but it's this little battery-powered token.
USB key thing?
No, it looks like a USB key. It's about that size with a screen on it, but it is completely self-contained.
Oh,
and just every 30 seconds, a new code appears on the screen of it, and I have no way of controlling it. And so that is a second factor. It's just that
it's not related to anything going on with your other stuff. And so Authy would be a second factor because it's not where your password came from.
As long as it's truly not where your password came from, right? If you have your password stored on your phone and Authy is also running on your phone, it could be argued. I mean, it starts to into a gray area. This is why people, again, the security folks get all hand-wavy about Apple's scenario too, because Apple will send you a code and it appears on the very machine that you are logging in from. It's like, hey.
Yeah, I've had that happen to me and I've gone, somewhere one of my security friends is like, oh, what just happened?
Yeah.
It's bugging me and I don't know why. Yeah.
So, anyway,
of these things make it more secure for you to do what you're trying to do. So, if you, like, for example, there are some authentication mechanisms where you get a phone call and a robot voice reads you some sort of code that you have to enter. And something like that requires that you have your phone in your possession and that you get this phone call and that you've given your phone number to this, whatever the service is, so that they can call you. And sometimes there's that second piece of it that you have to use that is sometimes two-step, and depending how you have your personal workflow set up, two-factor. And anything that you can do to make that password unique, like using a password manager, like I don't know my LinkedIn password, I'll tell you right now. I let 1Password generate it for me, and it's like a 50 character random thing after the last LinkedIn data breach. So I went, I'll show you. And same with Facebook. I think whatever the maximum number of randomly generated character passwords is in 1Password is my Facebook password. So I don't know that one either. At the beginning, like making sure that you have a good password and that you're using something like Authy or something else to back that up is super important. But Andrew, what else did you find?
Yeah, so the second step you can do is, you know, just don't use your LinkedIn account as a single sign-on. Don't link it to other apps and services. I know it's convenient, but it also removes a bit of control that you have, because you don't know what kind of data that LinkedIn is giving these other apps. And you can do that with other things like Google and Facebook, but that's the reason why Cambridge Analytica happened with Facebook, is because people link their account to all these different apps.
Mm-hmm. And the thing to think about with that is that if somebody were to get that password, whatever password it is, then they don't need your LinkedIn password because you're signing in with the other thing. So, mm-hmm. And this would be the same sort of thing. Like if somebody gets your LinkedIn password, they have access automatically to everything where you clicked on a sign in with LinkedIn button.
Yeah. So
that's the other reason my Facebook password is like 900 characters, but I also never use it for anything, you know, given the opportunity, because it's the same amount of work, which is 2 keystrokes. To let 1Password fill in something individual as opposed to clicking on a sign in with Facebook button. And I always look at it and go, it'd be easy. I'm like, no, I'll just let it.
Take 1Password. As I often say, we choose our point on the continuum between ultimate security and ultimate convenience, right?
Yes.
Ultimate security would be akin to living in a house that is entirely brick with no doors or windows. Very, very difficult for people to get in. Also very difficult for you to get in or out.
Or out.
right. Yeah. Ultimate convenience obviously is, you know, no doors at all. You just walk and come and go as you please. Whereas it is convenient to log in with Facebook's ID or Twitter's ID or LinkedIn's ID or your Google ID anywhere that will let you, it opens up this door. So you don't pick that convenience. Pick the convenience of a password manager, so that at least you have a separate password for each of these services, and let your password manager kind of do that work for you. And, mm-hmm. and so you can be almost as convenient with a password manager while also being way more secure.
Yeah.
And one of the nice things about that is having it be individual. You can let you, like I said, you know, like we talked about, your password manager can do that for you, and whatever password manager you choose, it's in their interest to make sure it's available everywhere. So don't worry about like, what if I want to do this on my phone? You probably can by using the same password manager, whatever that may be.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And then a couple more steps you can do. LinkedIn lets you turn off targeted ads. So you can go into the go under your profile into the settings and privacy section, and there's a little toggle that you can use to turn it off.
Huh. And that increases your security because the ad vendors don't get to know that your IP address is mapped to one of their criteria. Is that
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Okay. I mean, it's not going to, you know, remove ads completely. Just
sure.
They won't be tied to you.
Right, right. That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Because when an ad appears, sometimes, depending on how it all goes, the vendor can set a cookie. Safari's actually pretty good at making that not happen. But yeah, interesting. Huh. Cool.
And then finally, Lifehacker recommends turning off this thing called participate in research. I'm not sure what kind of research LinkedIn does, but you can turn that off again by going into settings.
I'm glad you can turn it off, but now my takeaway is that they're doing some sort of research. Like, what would that be? So,
yeah.
But it's always good to make sure that you review some of those preferences, some of those options available. You can do a lot of that stuff. It's good to review those things occasionally anyway, because, you know, sometimes you have that, like, authorize this app to use Twitter for whatever you're trying to do and things like that, and it's good to go in once in a while and clean that stuff up. So I'm sure we'll talk about more of that more of that soon. We tend to have guides for things like that, so keep an eye on TMO and we will talk to you about it. Right now, what I want to talk to you about is our sponsors. And our first sponsor is Hopsy. And Hopsy is sort of like having one of those Keurig machines for coffee, but it's for beer. And it's really great. You have this little device that sits on your counter. One of the things that I like about it is the suction cups on the bottom. So when you're trying to use it, it doesn't shift around too much. It keeps the beer nice and cold in the unit. The machine itself is called a sub. When I got it all set up, Mr. Kelly actually said, this looks like a really cool, like, what are you setting up on the bar? It looks like a really cool subwoofer. So it turned out to sort of look like that. It fits nicely. Like I said, I have a bar in my basement and it looks really nice there. It's sort of part of the scenery now. You can get a variety of different beers from it. If you're an IPA person, if you're just a lighter beer sort of person or a stout person, there's lots of options available for you from larger breweries and smaller breweries, and they're going to be regional to make sure that the beer that you're getting is fresh. They change selections a lot of the time, so every time you go and check something out, you can get something new. It's really easy to set up the machine. It's really easy to swap out the containers of beer as you put those in. It's pretty great. And if you want to try it, you can try that by going to tryhopsy.com, and that's tryhopsy.com/TDO, and you can get the sub home machine, two mini kegs of beer, which is like 2 6 packs, two Hopsy glasses, and free membership in the monthly beer club, and it's $99. Add the promo code TDO so you get the deal. Terms and conditions apply, but I'll tell you again, that's the machine, two mini kegs, two glasses, and free membership in the club for $99. Promo code TDO, and that's tryhopsy.com/TDO. And our next sponsor is one that's actually sort of seasonal, believe it or not, and that's Jamf Now, because you either just came back from a trip to your to go do things with your family, or you're planning one at Christmas time to go do things with your family, and one of the easiest things you can do is get them set up with something like Jamf Now. Jamf Now will help you set up, manage, and protect Apple devices on demand. It works for macOS devices, iOS devices, so you can get everybody's new computer, everybody's new phone, or everybody's new iPad, and keep track of the operating, the OS version, the serial numbers, in case you need those for things. You can manage settings like Wi-Fi settings or email settings, and you can do a lot more to help resolve a lot of issues that people have with their devices. And if you're going to listen to this podcast, you're probably the person in your family that gets called for help. So this is a really good way to do that. You get three devices for free, and additional devices are $2 a month. So if you go over to the Jamf website, which is jamf.com/TDO, you can get a free account. And again, three devices for free, and additional ones are $2 a month. So the next time you get your hands on somebody's iPhone or somebody's computer, just go get it enrolled under your account, and then you'll be able to manage all that stuff even when you're not visiting. Again, that's jamf.com/TDO, and you can get your free account today. Now, the last thing I want to talk about today, our second topic, is a really interesting thing that we found where Washington, D.C. has posted laws on GitHub. Now, Dave, I want to talk to you about this. I think you were the, I think you found it.
Yeah, well, I think actually Andrew found it, but I found that I liked it. well, it's just such a cool thing, right?
It's really nifty.
Yeah. As you pointed out, Andrew, it's not a copy of the laws that are on GitHub, but the actual source of the laws. Now, for those of you who don't know what GitHub is, GitHub is a version control system as a sort of a big umbrella term. And what that means is it's a place where you can store your source code, either publicly or privately, generally built for source code, but clearly can be used for, say, the source code of the law of the land.
But it's also really good for documentation as you go through
documentation
versions of things. So one of the advantages of version control systems for people who aren't well versed in this is, suppose you are a person developing software and you want to add a new feature, you can make what's called a branch, and you can take that source code and you can build your new feature. And then if it turns out to be really broken, you can always roll it back and go back to where you started and then continue on a different branch. Or you can take that branch and merge it into the main stuff. Once you know everything works like it should, you can merge that, and then it becomes part of all the code that everybody uses. And then the next person that checks it out gets your new feature and can start their own branch working on something new. So it makes it so that multiple people can access the same code base and make their own changes. And then you have ways to make all of that stuff work together.
And that's exactly it, is multiple people. And you get to see who made what change, kind of like you do on, say, Wikipedia, if you were to dig into that.
Yeah.
And I'm actually sort of curious that they chose, DC chose GitHub and not Wikipedia for something, or a wiki. I don't want to say Wikipedia, that's a website, but chose GitHub instead of using a wiki for this. But because in some ways it feels like a wiki might actually be a better way, but maybe not. But I just think it's great because you get to see the process and see who made what change and where the law is at this point in time, as opposed to, oh, it's in committee and it's being messed with. And I'm sure that'll still happen. But then once it comes out of committee and those changes are approved and rolled in, now you get this historical sort of timeline that you can see of how these things happened. I think it makes a whole lot of sense.
It really does.
We're in a world today where people say, and not incorrectly, things like, oh, we can use a blockchain to track that, and that way we know that these things are accurate and no one has tampered with it. Mm-hmm. And that's great. But even just using a tool like GitHub, which has been around for a very, very long time, or version control in general for laws, makes a ton of sense to me. So, and I assume it did to you, Andrew, which is why you wrote it up, right?
Yeah, I think it's really neat.
Yeah.
I mean, GitHub is available. It's free. It's on pretty much every platform you can think of. It's easy to search for things. So, yeah, it's really neat, and hopefully other states will follow suit.
Yeah, it's transparent, which I think is really great. You can go, like Dave was saying, you can go in and look and see who made what change at what time. And this isn't just like a law that they're sort of trying this with. Washington, D.C. made this the central repository for everything. And this isn't a copy. This isn't like, now that we've filed it and it's a done deal, we're going to go put it on GitHub. This is where Washington, D.C.'s laws live now, which is the part that I think is really interesting. And I hope it's contagious, too. I would really like to see this in Oregon. We tend to be a state where data tends to be pretty readily available. So I would really like if we had something like this that we could use here, or if nothing else, in Portland, because Portland has a whole lot of data that is available to anyone who asks. And this is the kind of stuff that it sounds like a pretty Portlandy thing to do. So I'm interested to see how this is going to turn out. I would like to see it be a little more common, because with the other thing about using version control is that somebody else has to be in charge of, like, it's good practice to have someone else be in charge of merging that code, like I talked about before, where like I can, you know, make a proposal or make a change in some way. Like the one of the people, the quote in your article, Andrew, is that there was a typo, somebody made an edit and then sort of submitted that edit, like, this is, here's a typo and it needs to be fixed, and submitted that, mm-hmm. and then it was up to someone else to make that part of the actual code, or in this case the actual law. And I really like using version control, and GitHub in particular is something we do with the AppCamp apps and with some of the AppCamp documentation, which is pretty great. That's why I was sort of not surprised to see, like, oh, somebody's using it for documentation and not executable code. It looks really cool. And if this is something that, or something, you know, if there's other like data transparency that's happening where you are, we totally want to hear about it. You can find us at TMO Daily on Twitter, and you can write to us at observations@macobserver.com. And with that, I want to thank both of you for being here today. Thanks so much, Andrew.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Dave, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Fun stuff.
And with that, I will talk to everybody tomorrow. And until then, be excellent to each other.